I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor.
I'm here with Professor Deepak Lal, who is one of the world's leading development economists and a man who's had a quite extraordinary life, really. You've worked in India, Australia, California, the Kenya, the Philippines, pretty much everywhere.
Well, yes, that's true.
With the UN, the OECD, Cato Institute, you were chairman of the Mont Pelerin Society. In short, when it comes to sort of working out what makes people wealthy and happy, there are few people with as much experience or expertise, I think it's probably fair to say. But I wanted to start in a sort of rather different place. I was reading your biography and you mentioned that after taking the Indian civil service exams and coming in the top 15 out of 20,000 people, you were sort of trained up for the job of a district officer, which in those days involved compulsory horse riding on the curriculum.
Yes, and I refused. I told every morning, the first thing you had to get up at 6. And there were these fierce sergeant majors, I suppose, who were supposed to, make sure you didn't fall off your horse. And I don't get on well with horses, so I just slept by all these other people. And then I was hauled up before the, what are they called, deputy director or something. And he said, why? And I said, no, I don't like horses. So he said, you won't be able to join the service. So I said, I told him, well, in which case, I think I'll have to talk to my member of parliament and say I've just been chucked out of the Front Service because I refuse to partake in an imperialist activity, horse riding. So he backed down and I never rode a horse there.
But I like that story because it speaks to two sort of themes of your work. One is just there's the sort of level of development that, when you started off, the countries you were working in were poor on a level that we find very hard to understand today. And the other, of course, is the state and the sort of central, the vast central bureaucracy. And you talk about your career as sort of you sort of started out as a Fabian who was going to save India through the power of central planning, and then gradually sort of seeing
the turning point. And people keep asking me this was, I went and worked for 1 year in the Planning Commission. And I was the advisor to the minister. And the first thing he asked me to do, he said, oh, you obviously speak English very well. Now, here's a third five-year plan, and I'd like you to edit it. And that bit, I had to go around with all these people, and he had written their bits and pieces. It became apparent to me. First, they didn't like the English being. There's one chap, a Sikh, and he got very hot under the collar when I asked to change his rather wretched English anyway, but the most important thing is that it meant how these things were put together. It was quite clear. They had no basis. It's just out of the air, taking numbers, plucking numbers. And there was a huge contretemps between two members of the commission. And that was all about what the next five-year growth rate should be. No one had any idea. And they were arguing whether it should be 3 or 3.5%. It's absolutely absurd. So that convinced me this was just mad. And the point is, they also have this terrible attitude of business and businessmen. And this is also the parent Indira Gandhi. In fact, we're still living the effects of this. She had this left turn. She joined with the communists to do in her Congress Party stalwarts. And then she nationalized the banks, and that's still a problem with India. They're still suffering the consequences of this. and many other things. This whole socialist stuff was really doing. And that was a disaster. And I used to argue against it. And people would say, well, you don't know how bad business went out. I said, business might be bad, but it's their money. And now you're taking all this money and throwing it into the bin. No effect. So it really took till 1991 when the effects of the socialist experiment were quite clear that this is not working. And then Manmohan Singh, he then started liberalization, and that has changed things. So now it's slowly moving out of that, and now hopefully it'll rise again.
Were you an influence on Singh at all? Because you published this basically a demolition of development economics, yeah. Saying the orthodoxies are so yeah. Just to explain to the readers.
I like to believe that it was quite influential, because when I go around, I mean, the only thing people have read of mine when I go around the world, it's been translated in God knows how many languages. I'll tell you the best story about this. This was when I was in China. And I used to go to Peking University, so, even in China, you get 150 people in your lecture hall. This time I went, this is after they brought out a pirated Chinese edition of this book. I suddenly arrived there, the people crawling out of the windows, etc., etc. I asked my friend, Justin Lin, I said, what's going on? He said, oh, your book has just been published, it's a bestseller. So I said, can I get a copy? He said, no, it's completely sold out. So then I arrived in Shanghai with the publisher, and China had just signed the copyright agreement that day. So when I rang this chap up, he thought I had come to...
Especially just
to collect my royalties. So I said, no, nothing at all. I just like to get some copies of this. So he said, it's all run out, but I got 5 or 10 copies left. So next morning in my hotel, nicely packaged, ribbons and all these things, that's all. So I think it did make a difference because in some sense, what it did was it caught a mood. People were very unhappy with what was going on, and particularly in developing countries, they didn't like much of this stuff. And this first allowed many people on the other side, as it were, to find some support. I mean, some Latin American countries, I said, we always thought that this thing was crazy. And it's lovely to think that we are not completely crazy ourselves.
So for those who haven't read the book, I mean, what was your basic thesis?
I called it the dirigist dogma. That means effectively what people thought is anything moves, you control it and regulate it. And that is based on, plausible arguments. You can always make plausible arguments for this. But when you looked at all these arguments, they collapsed. I mean, essentially, they said that you have perfect planners to control imperfect markets. Now, the question is, well, planners, as I've seen it, they're imperfect. Of course, it's imperfect markets versus imperfect planners. And all the incentives in planning are wrong. They can't get the information. So you have to then, what Hayek used to call the division of knowledge, not division, division of knowledge, which is individuals' habits. If you can use that, that would, of course, give you much better outcomes. And I think that message, by and large, is now accepted.
But was this something that sort of struck you in a thunderbolt, or was it just a sort of gradual dawning of understanding?
No, when I came back from the Planning Commission, Ralph Harris is a very good friend at the IEA. So I told him about this thing, so he introduced me to Hayek. So I met all these people, and we had long arguments, etc. about him. And then, I think there was someone at the IEA, I've forgotten his name, who said, all this stuff which we've been talking about, why don't you write a little Hobart paper, which is where they started. So I wrote this up. I don't ever thought anything would happen to come of it. And that was very well received. So that then, I mean, that's mushroom because, it's taken up by American presses, etc. And I think it really caught a mood. That's the point. This was a turning point in some sense. We had had 50, well, not 50, but certainly since the 1950s is the Indian First Year Plan. 50 to about 80, you had... This was the thing, but it was declining. There were a lot of people who found this. So it caught a mood.
And that actually sort of speaks to another theory of yours, which is that the sort of crisis theory of economic liberalization, that people are only willing to do what it takes to galvanize their economies at the point when they absolutely have no other choice.
Exactly, staring at the abyss. And I think that works. I mean, if you look at all the liberalization, including the second world, Russia, China, etc., they always resisted. They know what to do. I mean, people there, but none of them actually are willing to do anything until they really are staring at the abyss. And I think that is true. It's still true.
But I mean, surely that applies more widely to the to developed nations.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if you think of the Thatcher reforms, it is that winter of discontent, which I still remember. You know, we were stuck in a lift once for 3 hours because there was a park cut. And you couldn't even, because you didn't have mobiles in those days. So you had to depend upon, but that itself was linked to the horrible. So that was a crisis. And I think, you know, in some sense, she very sensibly used it. I mean, there are many people who can't use it. Venezuela now is a classic case. And there's been a crisis, but I don't know how it's going to end. But at some stage, I mean, they can't continue like that.
So how impressed have you been sort of throughout your career because we were talking about planning, but obviously you get sort of planning within countries, but you also get the international bureaucracy of development. You rather wonderfully describe your sort of slightly tormented time in the World Bank as like, you know, it was like working in a medieval court where everyone is competing for the ear of the moment.
I'm now watching the Game of Thrones, and the Game of Thrones reminded me very much of the World Bank. People trying to do each other, they're different factions, they don't have territory in the same way. What do they do actually? They go around looking at the world. You see the trouble, all these international bureaucracies. Now the World Bank, funnily enough, was a very good idea when it was set up, no question about it, because you know, developing countries didn't have access to markets. But then you always get some charismatic leader who wants to, so McNamara, he came here, and after you know his Vietnam experience, he wanted to save the world. I was hired. He asked the Africa department to get someone to study Kenya because he thought he was very keen on Tanzania. Now, really, you know, this all this socialist stuff, and he's very anti-Kenya because dog eats dog, man eats dog. That was extraordinary. So he hired. So Paul Collier and I went out to do a study for the Africa group, and this was showing that, you know, Kenya done very well, and of course it didn't continue, but it did. And he hated that, and I think they suppressed it. So we finally had to publish this OUP book, which I think is done quite well, and this is sort of economic history of it. So he then set his heart on this poverty thing, but you know, he was an absolute planner and had Hollis Chair, and all they wanted to do is to find some top-down method of sort of doing it. It didn't work. That then was followed by this short interregnum where I was there helping Ann Kruger running the research program.
Yeah, and you built up the research capacity.
And at that time also the policy thing switched towards, you know, they had all these, what are they called, adjustment programs, which went for one way, using crises to get these governments to do the right thing. But that then collapsed because the inertia of the system, which is dependent upon it, I mean, of course, you know, some sort of dirigist policy, they all rebelled. And then Wolfensohn came, and he, by that time, partly the success of the adjustment program meant most of the third world had moved towards more liberal policy. So Wolfensohn then came, and no one wanted World Bank money, tied to all these stuff. So he then converted it essentially into a gigantic NGO, social, women, gender, all this sort of stuff. And since then, it's hopeless. I think it has to be shut down. There's no role anymore. And the latest chapter is the worst. I mean, there's tremendous dissent amongst the international civil servants there now. You see, the IMF, in fact, I describe it after Nixon closed the gold window, and it was really set up to manage the old gold exchange system, the fixed exchange rates. So it had no function. So since then, I describe him like Pirandello's, you know, actors in search of an author. They're constantly finding some play. And they did quite well after the first debt crisis, third world crisis, and then the subsequent crises. But when you look at what they've been advising and doing, much of it can be highly questioned. A lot of people have. And effectively, there's no reason for it to exist anymore.
But I suppose, isn't there an issue which India is a great example of, you know, that once a bureaucracy exists, it's reason for...
Very difficult.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing. And that's why a crisis is important. Because then, in some sense, you know, politicians, when they're faced with this, are willing to take these difficult measures.
So, which leads me to something I wanted to ask about. Do you think politicians generally do more harm than good? I mean, how sort of significant are they to the functioning of the economy?
Well, I've always believed that. I mean, it depends. Of course, the trouble is here. They come in so many different guises. Now, the trouble is, once you've made a mess of things, you know, and you have, you know, very often the economists, you can find economists supporting any position, the economists sitting there, then, and the bureaucracy is sort of entrenched, then you're in a position, then you really do need some politician who knows their stuff and is willing to take these on.
A Thatcher figure rule.
Yeah. Manmohan Singh, and it was Narasimha Rao, he was the person who was, took the, who decided to sort of the industry remove this. And the same thing was true of Deng Xiaoping. I mean, that's the other great good example, you know, the great crisis in China. He didn't know, I mean, he didn't know any economics, but he just thought, and they actually, I think I was on that, I knew this, Zhao Ziyang, he was a PM, and we all, the group of us, and he asked us, he used to come and sit in the people's, whatever, the huge house, and he was very open, he really wanted to hear anything. Only one time, I remember that he refused to answer any questions. And they had this system of, how do I describe it, controlling migration by having people giving them cards. It's called the Hoku system.
Yes.
That was it. Anyway, Kornai was, this meeting, Kornai was there, and he was answering every question about, you ask anything. So Kornai asked him, when are you going to give up this Hoku system? He excused himself, said, so go to the loo. He came back and never answered it. That's the only question he didn't answer, but otherwise. But he said, at that stage, they were very open-minded and they were willing to learn this. The best book on this, I still think, is Ronald Coase and his Chinese author. They've written a very, very good book. And effectively what they did was, they let people, you know, these grassroots capitalist things were rising, and instead of squashing them as the Indians were done, many other people did it, they actually used those as models for liberalization. And that is a very important thing. But now, again, for politicians, Xi has gone back. He's going back to exert control because he doesn't like this loss of control.
So, one of the themes of your career again is, you know, you win the battle in sort of 80s and 90s.
Pendulum swing.
Yes. So you get the, you know, but people start to accept that Malkit's no better than Mandarins, to use one of your phrases. But then you say that the forces of darkness reassert themselves in a new guise, where instead of sort of state planning, it becomes about regulation.
Yeah.
And that kind of then becomes the thing.
That's the next beachhead, if you like, for all these DDGs. And that is happening. It's all around us now. I mean, developed and developing countries. I mean, the worst, most egregious of this that I'm completely against is Dodd-Frank. You see, I've been a supporter of the old, the separation?
Glass-Steagall.
And the point is, people, I mean, a lot of these academics now, I'm completely against them, they keep saying, oh, Glass-Steagall didn't actually do anything, and effectively, you know, there was no need for it. But look, something which for 30 years, or more actually, 1916, this is 19, so nearly 50 years, had succeeded in avoiding financial crises. And it's a very simple thing, and my thing is that you should just separate commercial, and the reason, because you've got deposit insurance. I mean, none of us are going to monitor our banks. So once you've got deposit insurance, what you need to do is to have commercial banks control, you know, these investment bankers who have nothing there. And investment banks, they should just be partnerships, because it's their money, and so they can take whatever risks they like. And that is exactly the system which we had before this.
So now
it's terrible. Now, what is this chap, Goldman Sachs, which is a perfectly fine partnership, it's now a public limited company. So, you know, it's passing off all these risks over the general public. It should never be allowed.
And in fact, I was talking to Nigel Lawson, who was saying
he's on my side on this one.
Yeah, but he was saying his his sort of big regret. I mean, he was saying that, you know, his there was a sort of a decent regulatory system in place, in it, which
yeah,
was
the
then
Big Bang. The Big Bang got it in
effect. But no one. Well, his argument was that there was actually a regulation system in place, which was then further weakened by Labour, among other things. But also that his one regret is he never had the. Because there'd just been in Britain, there was this sort of axiomatic separation between merchant banks and retail banks, and he never thought he didn't realise that you might need a law because the idea that these two things would ever end up in the same place.
That's a cultural thing. I remember these investment bankers going to the city, and there's an apocryphal story that Neil Ferguson tells. I've forgotten which of his books. But this is a banker every morning, investment banker, used to come in at 7 o'clock. And the only thing, and each day he assumed he's going to go bust that night. So you just sit there and look at whatever had been done previous day to make sure there's nothing there which would bring his fears to life. Now, you know, that these people don't do this now. Once you've got this model hazard and you can pass things on. So that is a terrible mistake. But I think I did know that Nigel felt that he should have put in a law. I still don't know the story behind the Big Bang. I must read something about that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We've spoken mostly about sort of your history as a development economist, but you mentioned a few minutes ago the IMF was set up to guarantee the fixed exchange rate system. One of your other contributions to monetary theory was that as early as 1980, you argued for free floating exchange rates, which you know, given that things like the ERM were still in the future, was a controversial position. But that's now the orthodoxy again.
I can't see that going. Of course, all the gold bugs are coming out and Bitcoin and all that. But I think that battle is not good. We're not going to go back to that. I think floating exchanges are there. But actually the trouble with the international monetary system now is that, I don't know how to put it. You have people who believe that you can fiddle around with money in some sense, whichever way you like to put it, and that can actually have real consequences. And for good or bad, they want to fiddle around with it. Now, the great thing with Milton said, which people forget, the only effect fiddling on money has on either inflation or deflation. The real effects come out, get washed out. Now, that's been forgotten, so that you take the ECB, you take the Bank of England, even the Fed, they still think that fiddling around with interest rates, etc., is going to, through inflation, and it actually has real effects. Now that, I think, is a very foolish position, because what you need for the real effects is fiscal policy. I mean, so that's micro, and this macro you can affect the level of booms and slumps, but beyond that you can't do a damn thing. And that message is again very gradual.
So you'd say that the whole quantitative easing, ultra low interest rates,
is foolish. I mean, I can see that initially when you had this huge credit slump, then increasing the money supply to, I mean, you didn't want to happen what happened, and he was absolutely right to do it. But subsequently then using this fine-tuning by, you know, low interest rates, this is a complete mistake, it seems to me. I don't see how, well, it's absolutely absurd. And the balance sheet of the Fed now, it's extraordinary. I can't remember how many trillions it is. I did an article, I think, in the Cato Journal recently, which, was it Cato Journal? One of my Business Standard columns. And that, you know, the old story of booms and slumps, this is the Austrian one, meant that if that affected the natural rate of interest, goes back to Wicksell, natural rate of interest was unknown, but that's the rate of interest at which you, the, both the real and monetary economy is in equilibrium. Okay? Now, if the market rate of interest goes above that, okay, that means you'll get some slump, goes below it, you get a boom. And so essentially try and keep the market rate as close to this as you can. Okay, now what has happened, and this goes back to Greenspan, is that every time, let's say you the natural rate is fine, there's a big boom of some sort, then the downturn comes. Now instead of letting the downturn go and then you go back to the cycle, people dampen that. So if you look at the figures, what you get then is a downward slide of the natural rate of interest. It fluctuates. And that is not actual. This is just purely because of this policy. Yes.
It's as though every time someone catches a cold, you give them sort of steroids and
So they can't immunity. So and that's exactly what we're in now. We've got a decline. And people keep saying, oh, productivity has declined. But that is, product has not declined. It just... The monetary system has now led to a declining natural rate of interest. And people tell me, I talk to somebody, they say, now, oh, maybe it's below zero. So you can't have a natural rate of interest below zero. It's nuts. But that's the story now, which is, and this is a big, big foolish, the folly of this is that now you unwind these huge balance sheets. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I think that, like, this is going to lead to, I don't know what sort of crisis, but it could very, very well lead to a crisis again.
Your two most recent books both took as their theme the decline or threat to classical liberalism. Yeah. Is that something that you see?
Yeah, because I think this is a pendulum. You know, the best person on this is actually, what's his name, the Swedish economist, Heckscher. And he wrote at a time when, effectively, Dirigi's governments were the norm, they were trying to control things, bring things under thing, and to bring order. And then that could, in fact, that led to disorder, which we see. And then you had the pendulum swinging back in the 19th century. Then we had it back again after the world wars, it swung back to planning, Keynesianism, all this. So it swung back. But we could already see signs. I mean, I'm absolutely astonished. We've got a 1960s style trot who's now being, you know, adulation from the young people who should know better, and he could be PM. So there we are, here, this sensible country, the Thatcher had done all this, the pendulum graduation is shifting back. Today I see on my newspapers that my old friend Oliver Letchman is arguing for raising spending and raising taxes. He wants taxes because he doesn't want the debt. See, now, that is absurd. I mean, there's been austerity. What austerity? There haven't been any austerity if you look at the numbers.
And this is one of the things which worries me, just this idea that if we're not going to do austerity now, over the next 10 years, all of the pressures on public spending are upwards because of ageing population.
I wrote something years ago when I was at the World Bank. I was asked to do one of the World Development Reports. I think Martin Bulfo was with me then. And just looking at the figures on pensions, this is 1980s, it is completely unviable. And I predicted this at that stage, this battle between the young and the old, given the demography, what have you. And that's exactly what you see now.
So on a more optimistic note, your next book, which has just been sent off to
printers and press,
is about war and power, and in particular, why we shouldn't write off America.
Yes, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union and all this sort of stuff, At that time, I wrote a book called In Praise of Empires, which was looking at this whole international system. But this latest one, this was prompted by, I was in China. I used to go there. Last time I was there, I think 2012. And I was absolutely astonished. There was a huge meeting in Fudan University, which was both international relations, economists, etc. And in one of the sessions, a Chinese general who came up, and his basic line was, he said, you know, why are the Americans in the Pacific? Okay, they've got no business to be here. They need to go back to the first island chain, which is Hawaii, Guam, etc. So there's someone else, someone asked him, how are you going to have it? Ho said, we have to have a sharp, short war. And someone else came and said, last time someone thought that they'd do that in America, see what happened. Anyway, so that gave me the, you know, and then looking at their behavior, you know, I've been going to China. And then with Xi, there is no doubt in my mind that he's gone back on all the liberalization. He really wants centralized control. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal shows that now they've got a surveillance system in which the satellites can take each person's picture, match that, whatever they know about it, and actually know who someone goes through a red light within 2 minutes, or less than that, and the thing announces on the loudspeakers with their name, you've just gone through this, you're not allowed to do it. So it's terrifying. I mean, that. But the second thing is that he really does want to go back to the old Chinese, you know, with their idea of order, Middle Kingdom, the emperor is the one, and all the others are vassals. And I think that now is the aim. Now, Obama, to his credit, did recognize this. But then, you know, there was a damn squib, pivot to Asia. I'm just hoping that Trump, and so these matters, etc., will now take on China. But I see it's unavoidable. I mean, the Indians, there's not a single country around there. The only close friends, who they can call, are Pakistan and North Korea. Now, highly unlikely. And everyone else is ganging up against them.
So this book is about geopolitics as opposed to economics.
I mean, the economics is there because I think the origins of this, why the Chinese did this, was because they felt they'd done very well during the Great Recession, the last Great Recession, and they think but there's a lot about the relative economic strengths of these countries, and I take a very dim view of China's prospects, actually.
And an optimistic one of America's?
Yeah. See, all this stuff of productivity going on, the Gordon thesis is up the tree, completely up the tree. And there's nothing which has happened in America. I mean, it's true, the distributional consequences are doing very bad because of the globalization, but also this great, well, they're going to come out of that, and they bump back. There's nothing, you know, it's the only place which is innovation, which is tremendous. Now, we don't show up in figures, but that thing's partly because productivity is mismeasured now in this new age.
Because it doesn't take account of online services.
Online stuff. And, you know, it's very difficult to see how you measure that. In some senses, we used to do with, you know, hard stuff. But you can see inputs and outputs. Yeah, what are the inputs? What's the output? It's very difficult to measure. Anyway, so that is something. Now, if you think around, the Chinese said, you know, we're having patents, hundreds of patents. We're going to catch up with that. But these are all derivatives. Nothing new. I mean, look at the things which have happened in the last 10 years. Google. And what is this other one called? Zuckerberg,
Facebook,
Amazon, and then, you know, China has copied a lot of these, and Alibaba, etc., they're copies of this, but they don't have any innovation. And that goes back to the fundamental problem Xi has. And that is, I can't think of any centrally planned economy, unless it's defense. I mean, you can build rockets by stealing people's things, which has this innovative spirit, and you can't get that in a non-market economy.
So where would you sit on India then? Do you think it has
India,
more of that?
I think India now, I mean, it's still got a long way to go, partly because this backlog, if you like, of all this mountain stuff they've got to change. But I think Modi's got the right idea. Of course, the trouble with him is, you know, he's an autodidact. Now, trouble with autodidacts, I've always said little learning is a dangerous thing, and you think you know much more than you do, and you're not willing to sort of, you know, because of various reasons, you have a bit of inferiority. You don't know. Now, that's his trouble. And alas, the people he's got around him, I mean, one or two of the economists have really outspoken, the people he got around him, they're hangers-on, they're flatterers. Now, he's normally quite good at finding his out, but, you know, he's in a hurry. He thinks that he can find a shortcut of doing, a way of doing this. I hope he's learned his lesson, and this hubris would lead to nemesis. But he's our only hope, because the other lot are absolutely hopeless. And I still think that if he can get his thing, the labour reforms, land, infrastructure, then India could be drawing a 10% for at least the next 20 years.
So speaking of India, we were discussing before we turned on the recorder your articles on the Raj, arguing that it's, you know, that actually it was, you know, it wasn't as awful for the Indian economy as has been painted. Which I'm interested to know the reaction to that in India, and B, is that something you throughout your career that you quite enjoy picking fights?
Well, I suppose I'm not picking fights so much as I hate cant. That's the thing. So I wrote a book actually on Indian because the Hindu equilibrium, which on which this is based, and looking at all the evidence, going back and seeing. And also trying to explain the caste system. Anyway, but that meant that when people keep coming out, now this latest chap, this Tharoor bloke who's written this complete, you know, it has picked up the same old themes. And somehow one has to be honest. I mean, you know, there are two sides, and I mean, they've obviously bad things about the Raj, no one denies that. But on the other hand, attacking it for things which it did actually a great deal, amongst which Manmohan mentioned, I mean, you know, the English language, the common law, and the beginnings of English education. I mean, these are all really important legacies in India, and you could deny that and go back to the national stuff. See, while going back to Modi, one of my worries is, he's part of this old Hindu nationalist stuff. Now, on the one hand, they want to deny any legitimacy to the Muslim rulers. Okay, you can say. But as a result, they're also turning against, because they didn't in the old days, because all we read, they all learnt English, etc. They're also turning against the Raj, as with Tharoor, who's on the make. He obviously thinks he can do this. But where are they going back? They're going back to the old Hindu Raj, which is about, you know, Tharoor. Now, the point is, at that stage, true, I mean, you can find people who were, I mean, there was a chap who was a Machiavellian character called Kautilya, he wrote a book. But firstly, the provenance of all these is very dubious. And secondly, a lot of it is rubbish, scientifically. They think that we invented spaceships, we invented this, that, and the other. They find some Sanskrit words which describe something like that. Now, that is really, I think that is really bad. Because if they continue going down that road, then like China, I mean, you know, all the creativity, etc. will go. But let's hope not. I hope that's not lost. And this is just a passing phase. Anyway, but it's a mixed picture again.
But you were talking about, I mean, is there not an element of your own biography in this? Because, I mean, your family did extremely well under the Raj, and then in partition, yeah. you found yourselves on the wrong side of the border.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And, you know, and basically lost everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. And that, yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And in some sense, yeah, it is. I was once, but you see, the funny thing is, my family is on both sides. That's my father's family. My mother's family were nationalists. My mother, during the 1930s, were hurling, you know, as part of Gandhi's movement, she was hurling rocks at the police and all this sort of stuff. And her brother, who actually went to jail, they were all Congress people, and he actually became mayor of Delhi. He was a minister in Nehru's government, etc. So in some sense, we are completely split there, so the family. But they then, I think after partition, in fact, you know, no one, I mean, that was it. No one actually said, but you know, but the Raj, I think, did influence both sides.
So finally, you taught in California for a long time. I think some of your children are now in.
Well, my son unfortunately is bipolar. So he's an addict. He's not. He's in a rehab center in India. But my daughter is here. We've got grandchildren. So they live here, and we now. I'm a gypsy. I mean, people say, "Where do you live?" And I say, "You know, previously we had three houses: one here, one in Delhi, and one in California." Then when we retired, I mean, think about California. It's just too far away from everywhere, you know. And I'm wandering around. So we sold our apartment there, and we just rent something for 2 months when we go there. And otherwise, we spend 5 months here and 5 months in Delhi.
And obviously, this sort of international character gives you a sort of unique perspective on the Brexit debate. I mean, are you quite?
I wrote some columns. I will send them to you. Of course, I voted for Brexit, but the reason, and I also voted in '75 for joining the union, and what, like many other people who were pro Europe then, we slowly learned that we'd been sold a bill of goods. Because what I was told is we're going to have free trade. I didn't realize that the single market is not free trade. It's a protectionist bloody block with all these rules and regulations. And the second, they said, no, it's not a federal project. And my final thing was, which finally convinced this man, when the European Court of Justice was put above any British law. Because one of the big differences between the continent and this is there are different legal standards and legal things based on rights. Yeah. Now that, I think, meant a tremendous loss of sovereignty. Forget it. So this is not nothing. And that, of course, meant, you know, I mean, migration is that you can use it away. That's not the point. But this was, so the Brexit debate now, I find it absolutely extraordinary. This bloody Hammond now is coming up and trying to sabotage the thing effectively. I think she'd sack him, because she's lost the election, so she can't probably do anything, but she'd really sack him, because he's really off. But you know, even people, well, I think Oliver is probably a Remainer. I don't think he would be. I think he'd be on Hammond's side. George Osborne, of course, is sitting in the stand and sort of shooting barbs at, barbs at everyone. But the Brexit debate, I don't know what's going to happen. The argument I made is that is effectively you're leaving, okay? So there are two things. You're going to get back your legal rights. And as far as the economics is concerned, British adjustments go to unilateral free trade. There's nothing to discuss. I told some of the people, David goes there. The chap can argue about money. I mean, you can have arguments about that. But you don't have to do anything. Just say, we're leaving. And we're leaving the common market, all this sort of stuff. And we're going to unilateral free trade.
No specific bespoke trade deals?
We can have free trade, and they put up tariff. I mean, what, 5-10%? The exchange rate fluctuates more than that by within a year. So, and all these people are, you know, squealing about the city, agriculture, etc. I mean, you just say, we are free traders. We're free trade. You don't want a free trade deal with us? Too bad.
But I suppose that comes back to your point about regulation. I suppose that the obstacle to that would be that, you know, the service, the standards and regulations and all.
Where in Europe?
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, they got most of them. See, one of the great things she's doing in this great repeal.
Great not actually repealing bill.
Yes, exactly. So they keep that. All you do is, if that's the only thing, you just keep those standards for anything going to Europe. I mean, that's fine. So they can't complain about that. And if they put up tariffs, I mean, you can do it in two ways. I would just forget about it. I mean, 10-15% as many, be nice to them. But if they do, it does match it. But that is stupid. I mean, it's just starting a trade war. I mean, Joan Robinson, who was one of the most extreme dirigees you could imagine, she's for free trade, isn't it? And she made a marvelous remark, which I always remember. And she said, some people are throwing rocks into their harbors. There's no reason why we should. And that's exactly right.
And so you're optimistic about Britain's prospects?
What I'm worried about is they'll do some screwed up deal where they won't actually get out, and then have some long. I mean, this.
And then Jeremy Corbyn gets in,
Jeremy Corbyn gets in, and then we're back again to nationalised industries and all this sort of stuff. Now it's horrible. So I just hope this woman sticks to her last. let David Davies and his people do their thing, get out, and then you'll be fine.
Professor Lal, thank you very much. And if you like this, we'll see you again next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.